Good evening. I would like to start by offering you congratulations. You have made it to the halfway point in this retreat. So I want to give you a hand. Mm-hmm. Yes, you're over the hump, as it were. So Monday and Tuesday, you offered metta to yourself and to two other people for whom metta should naturally flow. Your benefactor, somebody who's been good to you, and a dear one, a good friend, perhaps, or a family member. And this morning, Khanda introduced the neutral person. This neutral person generally only requires a little more effort than the other two. But once you get the momentum going, the metta should flow for this person fairly easily. Tomorrow, I'm going to continue the instructions on offering metta to the difficult person. This person has also been called the enemy in traditional teachings. In the Visuddhimagga, the book that we've been referencing, it's referred to as the hostile person. So in keeping with our recognition of Martin Luther King's birthday, I'd like to start with a quote from a speech he gave in 1957. I just realized it's the same document that Kairaju used. It's a really good document. He was a Baptist minister, so in his speech he does use some Christian language, Christian perspective, and this passage reflects that. Later on, when I start talking about this from a Buddhist perspective, I may illustrate some of the things that he said that are similar to the Buddhist instructions for offering, or to Buddhist instructions for offering metta for difficult people. So here's a quote from what he said. It's a speech entitled Loving Your Enemies. So I want to turn your attention to this subject, loving your enemies. It's so basic to me because it is a part of my basic philosophical and theological orientation. The whole idea of love, the whole philosophy of love. In the fifth chapter of the Gospel as recorded by St. Matthew, we read these very arresting words flowing from the lips of our Lord and Master. And here's a quote. Ye have heard that it has been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies. Bless them that curse you. Do good to them that hate you. And pray for them that despitefully use you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. So this teaching, love your enemies, love them, is a core teaching. And you know, the Buddha said something quite similar in a bit of a more dramatic fashion. Is anybody here familiar with the simile of the saw? If you are, raise your hand. Curious. I know a couple of people that are. So in this simile, the Buddha said that even if bandits were to hold you down and saw off your limbs, you should not respond with hate, but with the following refrain. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare, with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. And then he says further, we shall abide pervading that person with a mind imbued with loving kindness. And starting with him, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. So that's the ideal. That's the ideal which we're asked to live up to. Now, for the rest of this talk, I'm going to move from the ideal to the practical and the day-to-day practicalities of offering metta to difficult people when you're engaging in metta meditation. So in order to make this meaningful, since you've, at least not on this retreat, have not offered metta to a difficult person, I'd like to lead us in just a brief meditation, an exercise, really. Moving through the groups, I've consolidated a couple of them, you'll see. Moving through the groups that you've been practicing and ending with a difficult person. And just so you understand how to pick a difficult person, if you've not done that, I've got a quote here from Sharon Salzberg's book on loving kindness, entitled Loving Kindness. She said, it is useful to begin with someone with whom the difficulty is relatively mild, not starting right away with an attempt to send metta to the one person who has hurt us the most in this lifetime. It is important to approach increasingly difficult people gradually. So the idea is not to overcome your loving mind state with stress, undue stress from trying to go too far or too fast, but rather pick somebody with whom you've had a little bit of conflict, a little bit of stress, maybe just somebody who bothers you, you know, somebody who bugs you. I would like to add, for the purposes of this exercise, I'd like to ask you to choose somebody that you know personally. It's okay to pick a complicated relationship here, because complicated relationships can often be difficult, but please do select somebody you know. You know, in this age, there are a lot of tempting candidates for difficult people in the broader world. But in my experience, we often experience the greatest suffering from interactions with people that we know personally. We have a fight with our spouse or a child or a parent, or conflict with our coworker or our boss. That hurts. There may be distress and anxiety from the larger world, but the pain of those things can really affect us. So think of somebody, bring somebody like this to mind. Close your eyes, and just sit to yourself for a moment. And actually, let's start with offering metta to yourself in whichever way works best for you. There have been some great ways to offer a metta for yourself. Just begin offering the phrases to yourself. May I be safe. May I be happy. May I be healthy. May I live with ease. And check in with your heart and mind and see if there's any metta there. If there's any metta feelings in your heart space, breathe into those. Like you're fanning a flame, fanning the flame of metta. Now I'd like you to switch to either the benefactor or the dear friend, either one, whoever works best for you, whatever allows you to connect most strongly to this metta. And do what you've been doing for the last couple of days. Just offer these phrases, offer this feeling, offer this intention, this loving, friendly state. Feel the connection with this person. Feel your heart open. And now switch to the familiar stranger, the neutral person, the one we practiced this morning. See them in front of you. Smile at them. And feel the friendliness flowing from you to this person. We may not know much about their lives, but we know they want to be happy just like us. Wish them happiness and safety. And now bring to mind the difficult person that I discussed earlier. Think of somebody with whom you've had some conflict, some stress. Picture them in front of you. At a safe distance, if need be, but really see this person standing in front of you. Imagine them. Just like you, they want to be happy. And as you begin the phrases, note what is arising for you. Take notes so you can remember it. Afterwards, you're going to have a chance to share it. Just love for metta for this difficult person. So let go of the difficult person now. Say goodbye if you like. And remember what you felt and what you thought and how you experienced this particular person when you offered the metta. And I'd like to ask Levi to open the chat. And if you would please, just type in a word or two of your experience for offering metta to the difficult person. What arose? If anybody had any difficulties arising, could you raise your hand? I'm just curious. Is it? Yeah, I see a few hands. Okay. Pride, metta was a command, flat, petty, aversion to metta, slightly awkward, irritated. Constricted. When I thought about my difficult person, I immediately felt irritation and annoyance, hesitant, surprising sadness for them, some tension in the chest, slight resistance, sadness, reluctant and irritable. I could offer him at it in a superficial way. Oh, there's a bunch of them here. You might want to scroll through them. There was a love. Hey, there's a love. Constriction, anxiety, indifference, mechanical, compassion, good. Somebody felt, there are a few people who are having good things. Here's anger and compassion, sad, angry, tense from the first word. Wow. There's some good, strong emotions coming up here. This is really wonderful stuff. It's amazing that you can do metta in just a few minutes. You can go through the groupings that quickly. It's wonderful that we have the time to take more time and do this and explore this over hours and days. But just to know that you have these experiences, there's a love and a tightening. Well, for those of you who had experiences of love and compassion, I bow to you. I bow to you. That's wonderful. And for those of you who had difficult experiences, you're in good company. You're in good company because it's very difficult for people to offer metta to the difficult person. In March 2019, I set a month-long retreat at Spirit Rock. I set on the March month-long retreat, and Donald was my teacher. And because I wanted to teach metta, it was suggested that I do a long metta retreat. So that's what I did. Everybody else was doing mindfulness for the most part, but I was practicing metta. It was really cool. And, you know, although the time was longer than the 6 days we have here for the week, the process was the same. I began with offering metta for myself, then a benefactor, then a dear friend. And I spent about 3 days, 3 to 4 days on each person offering these phrases. I experienced many of the same things that I've heard from you in the practice discussions. In the beginning, there was sleepiness and pain, and physical pain and emotional pain. But as I said, the phrases over the days, they started flowing automatically after a while. And at first, they feel mechanical. It's like, what? Is this going to work? Were the feelings, or I'm having too many feelings, or anything can happen, right? But for me, they finally started flowing automatically. And, you know, this was a mindfulness treat, and I was walking around saying the phrases, and I'm like, I felt like I was cheating, because everybody else was being mindful, and I'm just saying these phrases over and over again. I felt really good. It was really going well. Until I got to the halfway point of the retreat. And when I got to the halfway point of the retreat, the difficult person loomed ahead like a mountain on the horizon. You know, at that time in my life, I couldn't find any people with mild difficulty. There was one person that really stood out. It was a very, very difficult person. I tried to find other people. Right? It's like, I got to find somebody that's not so difficult, but I couldn't find anybody. And after being stuck for a day or two, I'm like, well, maybe I could skip over the difficult person. Maybe I could just go on to all beings. But then the Dharma intervened, or the Devas, or something did. And while it's generally not recommended to take notes on retreat, Donald has had the wisdom to suggest that I take notes in case I wanted to share insights with people as I'm teaching metta. And I'm so happy you suggested that, Donald. I found my notes for that retreat. Here is my journal entry from March 14. The retreat started on March 1. And it's unedited, so bear with me. 3/14/19, Happy Pi Day. You know, pi, simple pi, 3/14. Somebody put a pi, one of the yogis brought a pi in and put it in the dining room that day. Anyway, Happy Pi Day. And then I say, my concentration is weakened. I get fidgety and uncomfortable. I dreamed of that SOB last night. I want to kill him. I need to see that this hatred, anger, / aversion is causing me to suffer. It's killing my high. My samadhi, my calm, my peace had gone away. But what happens if I let go? Let's try. That was my entry, 3/14. So if you experience, for those of you that experience any resistance to offering metta to the difficult person, I can relate. 1,000 years after the Buddha's death, it seems that monks also had difficulty offering metta for difficult people. I think all the other teachers have mentioned the Visuddhimagga, that book written by Buddhaghosa in AD 490. It's also known as the Path of Purification. It is 794 pages long. And it presents many passages, practices, doctrines, and meditation techniques. I think it has 38 pages. I wrote it down somewhere. No, 23 chapters. It's 23 chapters. And one of those chapters is on Brahmaviharas. I think they call them the immeasurables, but it's on this practice that we've been doing and that we are doing. There's a free version available online, and I can post it on the reference resource section later. But I downloaded a copy some time ago, and I read this chapter, and it begins with general instructions for practicing metta. The exact instructions that we've been using. Very, very close to what we've been doing. This part of the chapter is 3 pages long. 3 pages. Guess what's next? What's next is a section that is 8 pages long called Getting Rid of Resentment. Getting rid of resentment. It is all about what do you do when you offer metta for the difficult person, the hostile person, as they call it, and resentment arises and prevents you from doing this practice. And you know, it's a long section, it's 8 pages long. There are 25 separate entries of the techniques suggested to get rid of resentment. And I would love to review each entry with you. But I'm afraid if I do, I might become the difficult person in your next meditation. So I've summarized it. I've summarized it for you. So I've summarized it and I've narrowed it down into some categories. These categories don't exactly follow the sequence in which they were presented. Because what it says is you do this, if this doesn't work, then you do this. But for me, we're trading off the sequencing for kind of an understanding of the overall overall offerings of these antidotes to resentment. I put them in categories. In the first category, I call process. And this is also the first recommendation. So if you're offering metta to the difficult person and your metta goes away, what do? You go back to the people for whom it's easier. You go back to the dear friend. Go back to the benefactor. Say the phrases for those people. Feel the metta. Offer metta to these people that you love. And when your heart is full of warmth and love, come back to the benefactor. If that works, you're done. You're good. If it doesn't work, then there are other things to offer. So that's the first category. The category only has one thing, and that is to, in the process, go back to the beginning, go back to the earlier people. The second category I call them, so it refers to the other person. And the first suggestion is that you think about the other person's good qualities. I mean, everybody has good qualities. Everybody. And Dr. King wrote several items about this in his speech. I've excerpted a few quotes here. He wrote, "Within the best of us, there is some evil. And within the worst of us, there is some good." And the person who hates you most has some good in him. The race that hates you the most has some good in it. Look in the face of every man. And by the way, he did not write it in gender-neutral language. I tried to, but I didn't change it here. So look at the face of every person and see deep down within them what religion calls the image of God, or what we would call Buddha nature. And Donald said, indicated we have this quality inside. He goes on to say there is an element of goodness that they can never slough off. Discover the element of good in your enemy. And as you seek to hate them, find the center of goodness and place your attention there, and you will take a new attitude. And I experienced this myself just recently. I'm a member of a native tribe. I was chairman for 16 years. And we have a chat group on Facebook. And on that chat group, we discuss tribal politics. And tribal politics is pretty much like every other politics. Everybody has an opinion, and they like to share it. And when you start sharing opinions in that way on social media, sometimes feelings can get hurt. And that's what happened with me. You know, we have members, our members live all over the country. There aren't any reservations in Oklahoma. So if an important decision comes up, a referendum goes out and everybody votes on it. We discuss pros and cons of votes on this Facebook group. Back in November, my cousin said something that really hurt me. I found it really hurtful. I was angry. And unlike years ago, I didn't respond. But I was hurt. And then maybe 5 days later, I sat down to practice method. And I came to the difficult person. And this guy, my cousin, Michael, his name just popped up. Michael. I'm like, I don't want to give method to Michael. I don't want to do it. He's always been kind of a difficult person, but I just didn't want to go there. I wanted to push him away. And then I remembered these instructions. And I remembered to look for the good in somebody. And what I remembered was, 2001, I moved here from San Francisco. I moved here to reconnect with my people, my family, my extended family. I hadn't really known these cousins. And he taught me how to speak in Apache. He taught me, without much luck, how to bead. It's really very hard. I'm not very patient. He tried to teach me how to do beadwork. And then he taught me the Christian hymns that our grandparents sang. In the Apache language. And I remembered the kindness he showed to me. And this resistance just melted away, just went away. Poof, it was gone. So I didn't have to take any further steps there. The metta flowed. So that's the first, in the category called them, about the other person, the first suggestion is to look for the good qualities. That was an example. The second suggestion is to remember that these difficult people suffer from their misdeeds. People who cause harm suffer from their misdeeds. So the suggestion is to have compassion for them. Now, under the Buddhist cosmology, you know, the belief is that there are multiple lifetimes and that one will suffer in a future lifetime from what they're doing now. Whether or not you believe that, it is true that people will suffer from their actions. They even suffer when they're taking their actions. So that's the second part of the them category. Third category is the you, or it could be the me if you're doing it for yourself. These are things that you think about for yourself, and there are five things here. Number one is to remember that anger only hurts yourself. It only hurts yourself. The Buddha likened anger to throwing hot coals at your enemy or throwing excrement at your enemy in order to hurt them. And what does that do to your hand? Ugh. That's number one, you're hurting yourself. Number two, you're hurting your mind. You know, the enemy has hurt you before in the world, but as you're sitting on your cushion and resentment arises, you're hurting yourself. That's your domain, and you're responsible for that, not your enemy. Then the third one is that resentment hinders meditation. Kind of my quote, I didn't really recognize that in that quote before, but I kind of described that. It hinders your meditation. If you want a good sit, try to deal with your resentment if you can. It's really important. I've noticed this just recently. Resentment arises and I let go of it. Like, wow, I feel lighter. I'm happier. And then the last two are some of the lists. I know you heard the list of loving kindness advantages. There's also a list of the drawbacks of resentment. If you're angry, you are ugly, no matter how beautiful you are. If you have an angry scowl on your face, you're ugly. You present ugly. People don't like that. They turn away. You can have pain from anger. You can be poor. You cannot have fame. These are the Buddha's list of things. You can have no friends. And when you die, you will not go to a heavenly realm. You're not going to go there. Not if you're full of anger. Now, the advantage, then the next one is to review the advantages of loving kindness. And you heard them before, but I'll just go through them real quickly. You sleep in comfort and wake in comfort. You have no bad dreams. People and animals love you. Devas protect you. You're physically safe. You have a concentrated mind, a serene face. And when you die, as we all do, it's easy. It's peaceful. And then when you're reborn in a heavenly realm. And just an aside, you know, it's often said that metta doesn't produce awakening, but when you go to a heavenly realm, you can awaken from that realm. So if you're looking for awakening, that is a kind of an indirect route to get there. So that's the third category, the category of you, about yourself. That's how you can work with yourself to reduce your resentment. The third category is the Buddha. And these are really three things to think about. One is to remember his teachings, like the simile of the saw. And by the way, the simile of the saw came about because a monk was mad that other monks were saying bad things about him. A monk was angry about that and upset, and the Buddha tried to work with him, and the monk wouldn't let go of it. And finally, he's like, look, even if somebody's trying to kill you, don't have this hatred, don't have this anger, don't have this resentment. So these teachings like that are inspiring. And you can also be inspired by what he did. You know, he learned this through direct experience. There are Jataka tales that talk about his past lives. They're not necessarily strictly part of the Pali Canon, but they are in this list. They're in this chapter. And there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, I think 7 past lives in which the Buddha was a king, and then a monk, and then a baby. So he goes from being powerful to less powerful to powerless as an infant. Then an elephant, and a monkey, and a royal snake called a naga. They sometimes have spiritual powers. In each of these lifetimes, he was brutally killed. Brutally killed, every single one. And the story, the kind of the moral of each story is that he offered no ill will as he was dying, as he was being brutally killed, no ill will. So perhaps that would inspire you. Now, Kyra Jewell mentioned the story of Devadatta, his cousin who tried to kill him. And in two of these attempts, the Buddha's spiritual powers and his loving kindness converted the killers. In the first one, Devadatta hired 16 assassins. One by one, they were converted by the Buddha's power and were said to have become monks and followers of him. And then the second was a rampaging elephant that Devadatta let loose, or he persuaded some elephant keepers to let this murderous elephant loose on the Buddha as he was out getting alms. And it was said that the Buddha's loving kindness was so powerful that the elephant stopped. And the Buddha petted his head and said, if you harm the Buddha, you're going to have a bad lifetime in the next life. You don't want to do that. You don't want to do that. And the elephant, with his trunk, took the dust off the Buddha's feet and sprinkled it on its own head. And then tamely went back to its stables and stayed there and was tamed the rest of its life. So you can look at the Buddha. And then the last category of these categorized resentment antidotes are two that I just call Dharma teachings. And one is that it is said that we're in endless rounds of rebirth. So your enemy may very well have been your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, your son, or your daughter in a past life. In the story of Devadatta, in the Lotus Sutra, which is not from our tradition, but it was, the Buddha said that Devadatta was his spiritual teacher in a previous life and led him to become the Buddha. That he owed him that from a previous life. So this idea that we're all endlessly reborn and all connected in these ways that we don't know. And, you know, if you don't follow or believe in rebirth, just think that we're all human. We're all human. We all suffer. We all have, and we can all be unskillful. We can all be the angry person. Not the angry person, the difficult person. And then the last of these, it's not the last one, is the last of these Dharma teachings is called non-self. And that's the idea to think of, and this is kind of a complex topic, but if we're all composed of these elements, earth, air, fire, and water, what are you mad at when you're mad at this person? Are you mad at their hands, their mouth, their skin, their earth, air, fire, and water? What actually are you mad at? And one thing to think of is that the difficult people are subject to their own conditioning, as we all are. We all are. And so that's the Dharma teachings. And there's finally one, if all else fails, there's one more suggestion. And that is to give a gift to the person. Just to give them a gift. So, this is not specifically about meditation, but it works. Has anybody ever gotten a Christmas card from a long-lost acquaintance? You know, it's like you're automatically, or some kind of connection like that from somebody. You feel good. You feel connected. So giving a gift, generosity, is such a crucial part of our teachings. That will melt the resentment between you and this person. So last night, Kyra Jewell spoke so movingly about loving our enemies. And both of us have used excerpts from Dr. King's talk of the same name. And the example of equanimity and lack of malice shown by Jack Blackfelt, that DC transit technician, encountering those young Trump supporters the other day, that was inspiring. The Dalai Lama talks about how he doesn't hold anger or harbor ill will towards his Chinese. He views them as his teachers. There's a story of a monk who had been held for decades by Chinese torturers. And the Dalai Lama met this monk after he had been released, and he said, "What was the greatest danger that you faced in the Chinese prison?" And the monk said, the greatest danger I faced in the Chinese prison was I would hate my captors, because that monk knew what hatred would do to his heart and what that would do to him. You know, one of my favorite stories outside of the Buddhist tradition is the story of Androcles and the lion. Anybody familiar with that? It's also known as Aesop's Fables. And Androcles was an escaped slave. He's also known as Androculus, if you use the Roman name. And he escaped his master, don't like to use that phrase, but he escaped that. And he fled the city where he lived, and he went out into the wilderness and hid in a cave. And when he got into that cave, there was a lion there. And this lion had a thorn in its paw. You know, we recently adopted a dog. A rescue dog, an Aussie Doodle. I don't know if anybody's familiar with those dogs. They're really lovely, wonderful heart dogs. And we took this dog out walking in the wilderness. There's a wildlife refuge not far from our house. And we went a couple of miles, and there's this yellow, soft-looking grass, but it's got spines in it. I forgot about those spines. And after about a mile, this dog was like limping, and I thought I was going to have to carry it. We had to stop, and I had to pick these spines out of this dog's foot so it could walk home. So it could walk home, and I later ran across this story about the lion and the thorn. I'm like, you know, a thorn really would hurt in the paw of an animal stuck in there, and they can't get it out. So Androcles encountered this natural enemy of human beings, this killer. And he was in a cave, and he felt compassion for the lion. And he pulled the thorn out of the lion's paw. And the lion befriended him. And the lion would go out hunting and bring Androcles, and share its food with Androcles. And he lived there for 3 years in this cave in the wilderness with the lion. And after 3 years, he was captured and returned to Rome. And as an escaped slave, he was going to be punished. And his punishment was going to be that he was going to be devoured by lions in the Circus Maximus, those spectacles they had in Rome, ancient Rome, where people would be distracted from the ills of society by these spectacle conflicts where people would be harmed. And, you know, they released these condemned people onto the floor of these arenas, and then the animals come out and they devour them. And that's what happened. They put Androcles on the floor of this arena, and they opened the door. Guess who showed up? His old friend the lion. And this lion didn't devour him. This lion loved him. So the emperor, I think it was probably Caligula, he was so impressed by the powers that Androcles exhibited here with his killer animal, that he freed him. And the lion became his pet. So like the Buddha, in this story from another part of the world, this person with his love, like the Buddha with the elephant, tamed a wild killer beast. So these are inspiring, and you might say, well, those are very inspiring stories, but I don't know if I can love my difficult person. Well, I have good news for you. You're not asked to love them. In fact, in the Visuddhimagga, what it says is you only need to develop enough loving kindness or friendliness towards this hostile person as you would give to a neutral person. So if you try to treat them as if they're a dear person, it's going to be too much. You're going to get frustrated. There's a lot of talk in this book about avoiding getting frustrated and getting demoralized. You don't want to push yourself too far. So if you can just offer enough loving kindness to think of the difficult person with as much open-heartedness as you share for the neutral person, if you're doing that, that's enough. So I'm a little ahead of schedule here. I want to close with something, with a little story. Because just offering enough loving kindness to a hostile person as a neutral person is what I did on the Mars retreat. You may remember from the beginning of the talk, I was stuck. I had this dream about this guy. I wrote that I wanted to kill him. I hated him. And what did I do? I repeated the phrases. Walked around Spirit Rock, repeating the phrases, went out to the wilderness, walked on the trails, repeated the phrases. I didn't want to say the phrases. Didn't want to do it. Against my will, I repeated the phrases. Or against part of my will, you know, this small part of me, this resentment part. I didn't want to do it. But 2 weeks later, at the end of the retreat, that'd be the equivalent of Friday for you, really, something magical happened. And here's what I wrote in my journal. 3:27, 19, 1:05 p.m. And excuse me if I get emotional reading this. I couldn't tell this story for 3 months without crying afterwards. I titled this entry, Awed by Love. I was getting lunch. For those of you who have been in Spirit Rock, the dining hall is down the hill from the meditation hall, and employees at Spirit Rock also get their lunch there. And I was getting lunch, and there's a buffet line, two double-sided buffet lines. And I was going through the line, getting my food, saying the phrases. I get to the salad, which is the end. I look up. There's Diane. Diane, who was the manager of our teacher training program. And I saw her, and I immediately wanted to hug her. Just like Donald said, I love you. For me, I wanted to hug Diane. Now, I like Diane. I mean, I like her. But I would never hug her. I mean, it's not a bad thing, but it's just like we don't have that kind of friendship, right? So there's Diane from, so anyway, Awed by Love, I was getting lunch. I look up and across from me, I see a familiar face. It's Diane from Spirit Rock Teacher Training. I want to hug her. I ask myself why. It's because of her goodness. Because of her goodness as a human being. And then I say, I've been feeling good about being around so many good people. You know, when you're on retreat or even on the Zoom retreat, right now there's 62 people here. And we are here because we want to cultivate goodness in our hearts and in the world. And I felt so good, so safe being around so many good people, practicing. And I sit down to eat. I sit down, I say my phrases, I eat my food, and all of a sudden I'm overcome by love. Overwhelmed. And I looked down at my meal and was like, this meal is made with love. The cooks at Spirit Rock, they don't get paid much money. They might be working on Donna, but they're not in it to get rich or, you know, have a fancy restaurant. They are supporting those of us who practice. I realized that my meal is made from love. And I look around the room, I think everybody here is here due to love in one way or another, even if it's just a cat sitter. You know, I was remembering I had a couple that stayed in my house for that month watching my cats. And that was love. It was an act of love supporting my practice. And I look, and there's a plaque on the wall of the people who've made contributions to build that building. And I realize this whole building, this whole place is built on love. That's what donations are. Financial donations are actually an expression of love, of energy. And I write, I'm surrounded by it, engulfed by it. I have to bow to it. I'm in so much awe. It's like I'm in the presence of God. All this love, this goodness, is the divine. And then I remember a Zen quote, which I don't know why, but I say, I remember the quote, the Buddha is your mind and the way it goes nowhere. I'm awed. And in tears, I feel so much love. I got it. I got it. This was 19 years after my first meta retreat. My first meta retreat was after a breakup, and I cried every day. 19 years after, I finally got it. So I'd love to tell you that my resentment for this person went away forever at that time, but it didn't. You know, you go back, you're in this rarefied atmosphere, and your actions create these conditions, and then you go back and the reactions, you go back to the right reactions and conditions come back. And in my case, it took a year and a half of practicing metta and letting go of resentment. I deliberately offered metta to this guy for a year and a half. Sometimes I didn't want to. And we had conflicts after that, which continued the resentment. But I think it was within the last year, he had a daughter who died of cancer. And I could feel in my heart a tremendous compassion for him and for his loss, because I knew he loved his daughter. And I can tell you now, I'm free from resentment. And my metta practice has blossomed. It is nothing the same as it used to be. My life has changed. You may not remember, but I said at the beginning, this practice has saved my life. And it has. It has. It has brought me life that I didn't know I've experienced it in a way I haven't known before. You know, I was agnostic before this. I was an atheist for a good part of my life, and agnostic, even up until that experience. So when I say I felt in the presence of God, it was a life-changing experience. My first religion was science. My father was a scientist, and that's what he taught me. You only believe what you can measure, what you see. And then this thing came over me, and it changed my life. And it's all because I said those phrases. I said the phrases for somebody I didn't like, but I didn't want to say them. And I kept repeating them over and over again. And I promise you that if you keep saying the phrases and you keep doing this practice, it might take 20 years for you too. I don't know. But it'll work. It can open your heart. It can make you happy. And it can bring you beauty. So I looked around for we often offer poems. I looked around for a poem. I figured, well, I'm Native American. I should find a Native American poem. But, you know, my tribe didn't really believe in compassion so much. We were Apaches, and we were fighters. But I found one from Joy Lynn Harjo, who, as you all who are familiar with her, know she's the Poet Laureate of the United States and a member of the Muscogee Creek Nation here in Oklahoma. And this is a short poem. It's called, "This Morning I Pray for My Enemies." And whom do I call my enemy? An enemy must be worthy of engagement. I turn in the direction of the sun and keep walking. It's the heart that asks this question, not my furious mind. The heart is the smaller cousin of the sun. It sees and knows everything. It hears the gnashing, even as it hears the blessing. The door to the mind should only open from the heart. An enemy who gets in risks the danger of becoming a friend. Thank you, my friends. Thank you. I love you all. I do. Practice well. Have a good night.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.